Hi, this is Dr. Bill Meyer, and thanks for listening to this highlight from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you want to hear the entire broadcast or more highlights from our recent programs, you can go to our program page at myfaithradio.com.
He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Welcome. So great to have you with us today here on the Faith Radio. And yes, you are welcome to join the conversation live anytime by giving us a call at that number, 877-93-FAITH. You can weigh in on our topics. You can ask our question guests. You can ask me questions about any topic that we discuss on this program. So we'd love to hear from you. 877-93-FAITH is the number. I don't know about you, but I have been very troubled by the sustained attack that we are seeing on our religious liberty in this country and on Christianity in particular. And I think the Indiana Religious Freedom Amendment, the big brouhaha over that in the past couple of weeks, I think that is just the tip of the iceberg. And I think we're going to see a lot more attacks on our faith in coming months and years. And I think if we're honest, if we're really honest about it, what we're talking about here is a conflict between sexual expression, in particular so-called homosexual rights or the right to gay marriage in this country, and our ability, Christians' ability, to practice our faith freely and to operate our businesses without threat of some kind of government punishment or intervention. And so in the coming weeks, one of the things I want to do on this program is I want to look at some of the myths about homosexuality that have been propagated by, first of all, the gay activist organizations and their allies in the media, the mainstream media, and certainly in academia. It's interesting to me because there are so many on the left side of the political spectrum that often accuse Christians of not being scientific, of, spending way too much time with superstitious things, and that, you know, really what we need is to, we just need to get down to the science of the issue and the facts of the issue. And yet, when we talk about homosexuality and we talk about gay marriage, there's a lot of facts that are not being presented to the American public. And unfortunately, I think there's a lot of Christians that are not aware of the facts. And let me just throw out a couple of them to you. First of all, there's this myth going around that a significant proportion of the American population is homosexual. A lot of people believe, according to Pew Research, a lot of people believe it's 10%. Some people believe it's 20%. One out of five people is gay. Well, let me just tell you, first of all, that is a blatant lie. It is about 1.5 to 2.5% of the American population. And that's according to research from the University of Chicago, perhaps the most comprehensive research to date on this particular topic. About 1.5 to 2.5%. So out of 100 people, we're talking about 1 to 2 people that is homosexual. Canada, which, as you probably know, is a very liberal country politically, they did some research just in the past 5 years. They found that 1% of the Canadian population considers themselves homosexual. So that's just one of the myths that's going around, and a lot of Christians have bought into it. Another myth is that homosexuality is genetic, that individuals who are gay were born gay. Another complete myth. In fact, the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association, both very politically liberal organizations, both very pro-gay, both of those organizations, if you read their statements on the causes of homosexuality, both of them say there is no conclusive evidence that homosexuals are born gay. Anyway, we're going to unpack that in coming weeks, because I really believe it is important for us as individual Christians and for our church leaders, for our pastors, to know the truth. Because the truth is not being presented by the mainstream media. And the truth is not being presented by the so-called, honest academics. And I'm getting more and more troubled as I watch what's unfolding in this country. So, I'll get off my soapbox here, but I want to talk about that again in the coming weeks on this program. Today, though, we're going to be talking about another critical issue in our culture, and that is cohabitation. The huge number of American young people who are living together before marriage, and tragically many Christian young people who are living before marriage, and what they're doing by shacking up is they are torpedoing their chances for a successful marriage. And we're going to be talking to an expert in that field in just a few minutes. First of all, though, before we dive into that, I found something this week that I think all of us probably should be aware of. If we have a tendency to lose our temper on a regular basis, you find yourself blowing your top more than maybe once a week, well, you could be setting yourself up for a heart attack. There is new research showing just how destructive outbursts of anger can be. One new study shows that people increase their risk for a heart attack more than 8 times shortly after an anger explosion. Other research has found that anger can contribute to strokes, to irregular heartbeat. It may lead to sleep problems, to overeating, even to insulin resistance, which can cause diabetes. Redford Williams with Duke University Medical Center says, anger is bad for just about everything we have going on physically. Strong anger, when we really lose it, it releases hormones into our bloodstream. And those hormones are adrenaline and cortisol, and they trigger an increase in heart rate, in blood pressure, and in sugar metabolism. Now, this can be helpful to us if our body needs a burst of energy for something, such as defending ourselves physically. So we're being attacked in some way. That anger, or protecting someone. You know, if a dad's trying to protect his wife or his child from some kind of a criminal attack, that anger can actually help us by doing those things, getting our heart going, our blood pressure, our sugar metabolism. It's that fight or flight response. But too much anger can be harmful to us, chronic anger, especially for people who are already at risk for heart disease. And experts in anger management actually have a couple of steps for curbing hostility. I'll just share these with you. One of those is to avoid assuming that other people are purposely attempting to harm or annoy you. They're usually not. And sometimes we make that assumption. That's just part of the sin nature. We just think that sometimes people are out to get us, and they're often not. It's also helpful to learn to tolerate unfairness in the world and to avoid having rigid rules about how other people should behave. That is going to torpedo you every time. If you have rigid rules about how other people are supposed to behave to make you happy or to do it the right way, you're going to be angry a lot. And then to take a time out when you are gripped by anger is also a good idea. You know, you've heard that whole thing, a count to 10. Boy, if you are having an argument with your spouse, just ask, say, you know what, can we just take a break? Can I take a walk around the block right now? Can we just take a time out? Because right now I'm too angry to discuss this rationally. And then when your heart rate gets back to normal and your blood pressure gets back to normal, you'll be able to enter into hopefully a constructive dialogue with your husband or wife. And finally, let's not forget what the Bible has to say about anger, because the Bible should be our guide in every area of our life. James 1:19-20 tells us this: everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak,
and slow to become angry. For man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. I'm going to read that one more time. I think I'm going to put it on my mirror. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. For man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. Well, it's 15 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. Our big spring share event starts next week. If you are a regular listener of Faith Radio and you believe in this ministry, we want to invite you to join us for that. Come Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week. You can learn more at myfaithradio.com. Coming up next, my friend Glenn Stanton from Focus on the Family tells us why it's a bad idea to live together before marriage.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. We would love to have you join us today. If you've got any questions for me or for our guest, and our guest is Glenn Stanton, the Director of Family Formation Studies at Focus on the Family in Colorado Springs. He's also a research fellow at the Institute of Marriage and Family in Ottawa. He debates and lectures extensively on the issues of gender, sexuality, marriage, and parenting at universities and churches around the world. Glenn served the George W. Bush administration for many years as a consultant on increasing fatherhood involvement in the Head Start program. He is a prolific author. He's written several groundbreaking books on marriage and family, including Why Marriage Matters, My Crazy Imperfect Christian Family, Loving My LGBT Neighbor, and Marriage on Trial, The Case Against Same-Sex Marriage and Parenting, which Glenn and I actually co-authored, although he did all the hard work. Glenn is a graduate of the University of West Florida. He has graduate degrees in philosophy and history, and he now makes his home in Colorado Springs with his wife and five kids. Today, he joins us to talk about his book, The Ring Makes All the Difference. And Glenn, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be with you. Happy Saturday morning.
Thank you. Well, before we dive into your book, I would love to get your thoughts on some of the stunning things that have happened during the past few weeks surrounding religious liberty in our country. And I know you've been following them closely. For our listeners who maybe haven't been paying attention to what just happened in Indiana, can you tell us why this is such a critical issue?
Well, it's a critical issue, and you're absolutely right, from, I think, two perspectives. And one is the perspective, just the issue itself. And, you know, you were talking earlier about just misinformation out there, and it is incredible on this issue how strong the conviction was from the left, but how far that was removed from what the facts actually were. This bill was not really anything about, whether people could serve gay or lesbian people. What it was about primarily was that the state, if they are going to infringe on religious people's rights and religious freedom, then the bill just simply said that the state has a very high bar to jump over in terms of determining when they could limit that religious right or that religious freedom. And yes, this issue of, when it comes to gay weddings and things like that, what is our rights? It included that certainly, but it was about generally just religious freedom and the role of the state to limit those things. It gave nobody no rights to do anything per se. It just simply laid out the structure for, the requirement required by the state in order to curtail anybody's religious rights or freedoms. Again, it wasn't necessarily about the gay or lesbian issue or things like that. But the bigger thing, the bigger issue is just the absolute manhunt, if you will, for people, against people who do not seem to think that same-sex relationships or gay marriage or whatever the case is a good thing. If you publicly believe that it is not a good thing, then you are just persona non grata. You have no rights. You have no ability to speak. You should not even be brought up in polite company. And the pressure that was brought against Indiana, against Arkansas, against things like that, I mean, just absolutely chilling and an indication of where we are headed. I mean, it's absolutely just the new intolerance, and we see it in such an aggressive way here. And Christians need to know about this.
Yeah, and I think more and more Christians are waking up. There are legal scholars that are predicting dire things for the future of religious liberty in the United States. Do you agree with their predictions, or do you think they're going overboard, Glenn?
Oh, no. I mean, and it is remarkable. I'm surprised with how strong they are voicing their opinions, but they're absolutely not. I mean, there are leaders within society. I mean, there are some that President Obama has appointed to equal opportunity organizations that basically say sexual freedom will always trump religious freedom. Basically, we have all the rights and religious people have no rights. And these are very serious people, and it is only going to get worse and worse when basically they have couched this position between, there are the nice, welcoming people on one side, and that's the gay and lesbian advocates, and then you have essentially Jim Crow bigots on the other side. That's how they see it. And, you know, people like us who don't affirm homosexuality, we are just like the segregationists of the South and should not be tolerated at all. Well, the point is, I mean, that's completely over-the-top rhetoric. It's mean, it's ugly, it's unfair. The question is, it was recent until President Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, those people changed their position on same-sex marriage. Did they go from being bigots one day to not being bigots the next day? I mean, it just, the rhetoric just does not hold up.
Now, you know, I was watching this whole thing unfold, and again, I've talked to some legal experts since Indiana. And I'm wondering what your opinion is. You work at Focus on the Family, a national organization. You talk to, Jim Daly talks to hundreds of thousands of people every week on his radio show. What can we do? What can we do as individual Christians and churches to stand up for our First Amendment rights and for the rights of other believers in our community, such as a Christian business owner, such as what happened to the pizza parlor owner in Indianapolis who dared to say that he would not cater a same-sex marriage and what he experienced. What can we do? Because really, I think there's strength in numbers. I mentioned before at the open of the program, probably about 1.5 to 2.5% of the American population is homosexual. You'd never know that their political clout, their political power, and of course their friends in the media and in academia. But we do have the numbers, and we do have incredible influence. What are some practical things that we might do if something like this happens again, and which it will, in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. North or South Dakota, Iowa? What should we be doing, Glenn?
Well, first of all is to get the details on the story, and don't get the details from the general media, because surprise, surprise, they don't always get it right. And what you will find out about these stories, there's a story in Washington State, very, very nice woman who runs a flower shop. There were two gay men that would come in constantly and get flowers for each other. And she would, of course, sell them flowers. They became close friends. Well, they were coming to get married, and she explained to them, you know what, being friends, I just cannot participate in the wedding ceremony. And they got their feelings hurt, but they understood because they were friends. But it was the Attorney General of Washington who took this case and said she should be forced to supply that wedding with her artistic creative abilities. Now, the individuals had worked it out, you know, and they understood. They understood she was a Christian and that would be uncomfortable for her. But then it was somebody else who came in and, you know, kind of butted their way in. And the stories that you'll hear about this is, and this horrible thing is, well, they may as well, you know, put a sign out in front, no gays served here. That is just ridiculous. And we all need to know how to argue against that. You know, when we're talking over the back fence to our neighbors and at the water cooler and things like that, and just bring the truth that that is just simply not the case. And this is a whole different thing to sell a cake over the counter of your bakery than to cooperate and participate with the wedding party and plan the wedding, plan the cake, things like that. That really is participating in the wedding itself. But here's the other thing that people need to know. Say it focused on the family. We had hired a caterer in town because he's the best caterer, and we were having him come cater an event where we're planning with national leaders how to protect marriage. And he knows, you know, he finds out about that, and he says, I'm a gay man. I don't really feel comfortable catering that event. Should we be forced to force him? I mean, should we make him cater that event? No. He shouldn't have to be forced to violate his conscience. And so these roads go back and forth, you know. When we can force somebody to act against their conscience when they're Christians, we can force the other side to do that as well. But none of us should do that. It's just an issue of plain courteousness and community civility to say, listen, if you don't feel comfortable about this, then we don't want to force you to do this. And again, that goes both ways. And people need to know those kinds of things to challenge and refute and correct just the crazy hyperbole that's out there surrounding this issue.
Yeah, and I also believe, Glenn, that as believers, sometimes we are reluctant to stand up and speak the truth because, you know, we have this misunderstanding of what it means, what humility or meekness means. You know, to be meek is really strength under control. And and yet so many Christians, I think, fail. I don't want to rock the boat, or I want to be loving in all that I do. But sometimes being loving, the most loving thing we can do is to speak the truth. And I think sometimes we fail to do that. We've got a break coming up, Glenn, and I appreciate so much your perspective on this. And I want to mention Glenn's other book, which we talked about at the top of the hour. If you want to read more about how to do this right, it's called Loving My LGBT Neighbor. And you can learn about that at Glenn's website, glenntstanton.com, glenntstanton.com, or go to focusonthefamily.com to find out more. We're going to take a quick break here on the Faith Radio Network, and coming up next, Glenn dives into the also controversial issue of cohabitation, living together before marriage. Why are so many Americans doing it, and what's the result? It's not pretty. Stick with us.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And welcome back. It's so great to have you with us. Our spring share event kicks off this week, and we would encourage you to join us for that. If you believe in the ministry of Faith Radio and you'd like to support it, we'd love that. We would invite you to support it. And you can learn more at myfaithradio.com. Our guest is Glenn Stanton, the author of The Ring Makes All the Difference, The Hidden Consequences of Cohabitation and the Strong Benefits of Marriage. Glenn, what are some of the current stats on cohabitation? What percentage of Americans are living together before marriage, or shacking up, as my grandmother used to call it?
And living in sin as the older generation, and that's not a bad thing. Well, first of all, we need to know that in terms of growth of family formation trends, you know, divorce, cohabitation, single, you know, parenting, all that kind of stuff, fatherlessness. Cohabitation is absolutely the fastest growing and consistently fastest growing family trend. That it has grown about 16 to 17 times over since like 1960. And it just continues to grow and grow every year. In fact, it's one of the numbers that when you look at these, you know, yearly growth rates in terms of these family trends, it's the one that really seems to change. The next one is out of wedlock childbearing, but not among teenagers, but among, you know, 20, 30 something women. And it's related to cohabitation. You know, many of them, probably more than half now, are having out-of-wedlock births within cohabiting relationships. So those two are the ones that are just skyrocketing. More than 60% of weddings today are preceded by some form of cohabitation. Either one or both of the partners have cohabited in some sort of way. It's just remarkable. And, you know, 75% of non-high school graduates today have cohabited sometime, and 50% of college graduates have cohabited sometimes. And this is true in nearly every Western, well, it really is true in every Western country, in Europe and, you know, the Americas as well. That's very, very concerning given the outcomes that we see from cohabitation, which, of course, we're going to talk about.
And the outcomes are quite negative. Let's talk about the motivation for living together before marriage, because there's kind of two. One is a low view of marriage. It's just a piece of paper. It's just the certificate. It's no big deal. The other is a high view of marriage. Person doesn't want to mess it up because maybe their mom and dad got divorced and, you know, they experienced such pain from that experience that they say, I don't want to make that kind of mistake. So I'm going to test drive this relationship. I'm going to kick the tires and make sure that he or she is the right person. So we'll live together for a while before we tie the knot. But let's explore both of those motivations and why so many people buy into them.
Yeah, and you're right. You laid those out very nicely, and I elaborate on those in the book. Is, you know, for older people, we tend to think, you know, that it's a negative view. Who needs marriage? Marriage is not important. It's, like you said, it's just a piece of paper. But for the overwhelming majority, 75-80% or more of cohabitors today have, curiously and ironically, a high view of marriage. People think, well, how in the world can they be cohabiting and have a high view of marriage? Well, it's exactly that. They have seen marriage decline so much. They desire to be married. They want to be married. If they could wave a magic wand, they would be married, happily married tomorrow. But they have not seen successful marriages in their own family, in their own communities, and they don't want to mess it up like their parents do. So what they do is, it's what I called, rather than jumping into the deep end of the marriage pool, they kind of wade in slowly, which in a sense makes sense. You know, let's test out the relationship. Let's see if we're compatible. But ironically, it's the nature of cohabiting relationships and the process of cohabiting that can damage the relationship itself. Curiously, there is nothing that young couples do today by their own will and choice that will do more to sandbag their future relational health, marriage or cohabiting, than living together before marriage. I mean, it's really quite remarkable that they think it's going to do one thing, but it actually ends up doing quite the other. It would be like using soap and, you know, this particular soap and thinking that it's going to make your clothes clean when it actually makes them dirtier. That is really what cohabitation does to relationships.
And why do you think so
so few people are aware of this. Obviously, there's, you know, there's a media and academic bias towards, you know, well, marriage is, as we said before, it's kind of outdated, it's archaic, it's just a piece of paper. Sexual expression is what's most important. You make your own choices, you self-actualize, and if that involves living with your partner. I saw Hoda from the Today Show or Good Morning America the other day, and she was on with Kathy Lee Gifford, and Kathy Lee, of course, was standing up for traditional marriage, and Hoda kind of looked like, you know, she did had no idea what she was talking about.
Wow.
Why would somebody, you know, think that they should withhold sexual activity until marriage? I mean, that's just ridiculous. So why is it that so many young people, especially Christian young people, let's focus on them for a minute, because we know, and I don't know if you have some hard data on this or Barna does, what percentage of Christian young people are living together before marriage, but they're obviously not getting the message that this is not good for them.
Well, and it's that issue of, unfortunately, we as Christians across the board, we listen and we take our cues more from the culture than we do from the scriptures. And luckily, or not luckily, but fortunately, the cohabitation rate within the church is much less than it is in the general population. In fact, the secular scholars will tell you that you know, one of the big mitigators against people living together is their religious commitment and religious affiliation. But you know, that's the question, is why do people believe something as absolutely true and reasonable that is, you know, it's as false as they think it is true? That goes back to the Indiana thing. I mean, there are so many things that the general media will have us believe is exactly just the opposite. But here's the deal, Bill, in doing the research for this book, and I haven't read all of the studies, I mean, every existing study, because there are hundreds of them, but I really have read probably 80 to 90% of them. And there is no research data whatsoever, if you look at it carefully, that makes the case that cohabitation benefits or improves any relational measure. Cohabitation significantly hurts every one of them. And the research, the secular research, the university-based research from universities all over the world consistently show that to be the case. When young people, you know, will say, pardon me, when young people will tell me, well, I just don't believe that, I say, go find me a study, a major study published in a peer-reviewed journal that explains that cohabitation is good. They don't exist. I know that they're not going to find them. And in trying to do that, they're going to realize that, yeah, cohabitation is not a good idea. And it's not just the pulpit-pounding moralists or our grandparents that are saying this. Our grandparents knew what they were talking about. Again, because the researchers came along and said, lo and behold, Grandma and Grandpa, they were right. They knew what they were talking about.
Now, how are marriage and cohabitation qualitatively different? Because there are some significant differences between a couple that is living together before marriage, or maybe not going to get married, and then a couple that is committed to marriage. If we just look at, put those two couples side by side, what kind of differences do we see?
Well, some big, big differences. And this is really interesting, is the mainstream scholars will say cohabiting is not a subset of marriage. Cohabiting is a subset of being single, in that, you know, cohabiting couples look more like single individuals and they act more like single individuals. But across the board, in terms of just physical health and happiness, married individuals are far more happy, healthy, contented with their relationship than cohabiting couples are. And the benefits of marriage are more significant for women than they are for men. The negatives for cohabitation are more negative for women than they are for men. Look at domestic violence. Domestic violence is sky high in cohabiting relationships. It is much, much lower in marriage relationships. A man with a ring on his finger tends to be more patient. He tends to be kinder. He's a better provider for his spouse than his live-in girlfriend. He's more likely to stay employed. He's more likely to work harder. Married couples are more likely to save more money and earn more money every year. And it's interesting that even cohabiting couples, and the data shows this, the woman is more likely to have to work, but they are more likely to live in poverty. So think about this, ladies. I mean, cohabiting, you are more likely to have to work for the relationship and in the relationship outside the home, but you're more likely per capita to live in poverty than your married peers. And what's interesting is largely that is true of people who make the same amount of money every year. Married couples share and use their money in much more strategic ways and much more beneficial ways than cohabiting couples do. I mean, it's the nature of the relationship. That's why I named the book What I Did. The ring makes all the difference. The issue of that commitment, and the commitment comes down to two things, really. That one, you have a commitment. You made your vows before your whole community that I am committed to you. I am not giving up. I am forsaking all other relationships to be committed to you. And so it's that commitment. It's that clarity. Everybody knows what the nature of the relationship is, which brings us to the second problem of cohabitation, and it's what the scholars call the ambiguity of the relationship. They did some wonderful study, and I presented in the book, is they took cohabiting men and women, they took them into different rooms, and they interviewed them by gender distinction, and they asked them, what do you think the future of your cohabiting relationship was? One group, and see if you can pick out who this is, listeners, one group said, oh, yeah, we're going to get married, and we're serious, and, you know, we're just kind of waiting for the right time. There was another group that said, yeah, we're hanging out. We're just having fun, just, you know, kind of just hanging out and see what happens. One group thinks that marriage is in their future. The other group does not. And so that means that the group that thinks marriage is in their future because of the ambiguity of the relationship, they are living in a false hope. And who do you think it was that thought marriage was in their future? I'll give you a hint. It wasn't the dudes, right?
Yes, have your cake and eat it too phenomenon, those cohabiting men, they're just satisfied, you know, having their cake, and there's really no plans for a future marriage on the horizon, and their sweetie pie really believes with all her heart that eventually he's going to commit, and they're going to go into a jewelry store and pick out a ring,
that's
tragic.
Well, that's why I say the relationship is the marriage is the relationship on the woman's terms. Cohabiting is the relationship on the man's terms. Men just generally, as a male nature, like and prefer low commitment kind of relationships because they get what they want and they don't have to give extra things.
Yeah, it's a sad indictment of the male. The male part of the species, and unfortunately, we're two guys talking about it. But at least we're advocating for the woman in this case. So we're talking to Glenn Stanton, and Glenn is a social researcher and the author of this new book, "The Ring Makes All the Difference: The Hidden Consequences of Cohabitation and the Strong Benefits of Marriage." We have three copies of this book to give away. You know, if you are a parent who has a high school or college-age student or young adult child, or if you're a pastor in pastoral leadership or church leadership, why, this be a great book to have because it lays out the truth. And we've got three copies to give away. If you call us right now, give us your contact info, say in the next 15 minutes or so, we would be more than happy to put you into a drawing for Glenn Stanton's book, The Ring Makes All the Difference. We're going to take a quick break here on the Faith Radio Network and be right back.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. We're talking about cohabitation today, living together before marriage, the large number of Americans who are doing it, large number of American young people, even Christian young people, who think that, well, it's a great way to test drive their relationship, to kick the tires before they get married. Glenn Stanton, our guest, says, thinking test driving a marriage is smart is pure fiction, having as much evidence for it as there is for Sasquatch, mermaids, and unicorns. I love that. I just have this image of Bigfoot, you know, and I'm thinking, yeah, there's about as much evidence that cohabitation is going to work for you as there is that Bigfoot actually exists, even though there are some that swear that he does. We talked about some of the negatives earlier. One of the things that we didn't get into is the impact on children, because a child that is in a married relationship, has married mom and dad, versus a child whose parents are living together, they have very different outcomes as far as on a variety of factors, health, psychological well-being, academic achievement. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, and that's, again, I mean, we can tend to think, well, it doesn't really matter how people are living. It's just, you know, who are the people and, you know, do they love one another? But increasingly, I mean, 20 years ago, cohabitation was kind of a young adult sort of thing. It was, you know, people in transitional times in their life living together before they get married. But increasingly, cohabiting couples are the ones that live in our neighborhoods, on our cul-de-sac. And, you know, upwards from 40% of cohabiting homes today include children. About 60% of kids, 70% of kids, unfortunately, can expect to live part of their childhood in some sort of cohabiting home. Now we need to understand that it doesn't mean that kids are doomed if they live with a single parent, but most single parents know that it is more of an uphill climb and it's more difficult. Kids in cohabiting homes tend to look more like kids in single parent homes. They are less likely to stay in school. They're less likely to do well in school. They're more likely to have physical health problems. They're more likely to have psychological health problems. They are, dramatically more likely to be sexually abused, especially when they live with mom and her live-in boyfriend. If biology matters, biological dads are not as likely, whether they're married or not, to abuse their own biological children. Although, if a biological dad is not married, he can tend to be, unfortunately, more likely to physically, emotionally, sexually abuse the children. But with mom living with her live-in boyfriend, you can't say nearly guaranteed, but you can come close to saying that. And I would say straight out, if you know somebody in that situation, you need to intervene and make sure that that man, that unbiologically related man, and that doesn't include adoption, because adoption is a commitment, a deep commitment. But the live-in boyfriend, he doesn't have that commitment, and that is a very, very serious situation. Drug use and things like that, kids growing up in cohabiting homes, they're more likely to, you know, use illicit drugs, be sexually active before they're married, things like that. Poverty is the big thing. We think, well, you know, these are homes, married or not, that have two incomes, two checks coming in. Kids aren't likely to live in poverty. Well, when they live in cohabiting homes, they are about three times more likely to live in poverty than kids living with married mom and dad. I mean, it's just remarkable. And if society is judged by how well it cares for its children, and cohabitation has a huge consequential impact there. So again, it's not just the moralist busybodies that are against cohabitation. The scholars themselves that know the data and are honest about it, they know that cohabitation is really not the way to go.
Boy, you know, it's just there's so much evidence, and you know, we've just touched on a few things that impact these cohabiting relationships. Another we really didn't discuss, excuse me, is fidelity, sexual fidelity. That a married individual is much more likely to be faithful to their partner than somebody who's cohabiting. Comment on that, if you would.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, what's really remarkable is a live-in boyfriend is about four times more likely to be unfaithful to his girlfriend than a married man is. And again, it's that ring that makes all the difference. But get this, Bill. I mean, women tend to be more sexually conservative than men, but in the cohabiting relationship, the data says that a woman is eight times more likely to be unfaithful to her spouse than a married woman is. And the issue there is women are looking for not just sexual release and you know, the sex part of it. They are looking for intimacy. And when they don't get it, they're less likely to get that in a cohabiting relationship because, again, like we said earlier, the man is getting everything that he wants. He is less likely to invest his emotion, his care for this woman that he's living for. So she's going to go out looking for it more often. And unfortunately for men who aren't going to give her that in the first place, that kind of tenderness, that kind of emotional closeness. And so she will kind of look at it, look for it in that old country song, looking for love in all the wrong places. And that is why the infidelity rate in cohabiting relationships is so high, particularly for women.
It's funny, as you were describing that, I was thinking, this does make a great country song. We ought to call Tim McGraw because he could write a good one about together, you know. Glenn.
Well, sorry. And that's the thing is, you know, ladies, how many of you would like to be in a relationship where you think the relationship is going somewhere, but it's not, where you are going to be more inclined to, you know, be driven toward infidelity, where your boyfriend is not going to be as faithful to you? You know, show of hands, ladies who wants that? Cohabitation is what you're looking for then.
It's a sad state of affairs, and unfortunately, as we've said before, most Americans, a lot of young people aren't aware of it. They're not hearing about it in the media. They're not hearing about it often from their own pastors. How about issuing, we just got about 3 minutes left, Glenn, if you would, issue a challenge to the church and to pastors to make this issue more front and center, more of a priority in their teaching?
Well, first you've got to know the facts, and not to pitch or sell the book, but I wrote this book as a handy little manual that just gives the research and cites not the research that I was looking for, but just the mainstream research that tells the story. And it's a super usable little book. It's cited. It cites the data, the research. You can go look it up yourself. But know these facts and know to be able to talk authoritatively. And for those who teach, you know, young adult Sunday school classes, for pastors, for counselors, for parents, know this stuff and be able to speak convincingly and truthfully to young people and say what you think you know is just simply based on nothing but wishful thinking. Here's what the facts are. And they really do drive well-being. We need to know the facts. You know, Christians need to be smart about these things. And it does show that God knows what he's talking about. All this research backs up what God says. When God says, you know what, the husband leaves his mother and father and cleaves to his wife, all this research is basically saying, you know what, Jesus knew what he was talking about there.
Boy, that is so true. And isn't it wonderful, and I know you and I both agree on this, when we see contemporary research matching what we read in Scripture and really backing it up, even for those people who may not believe in the Bible, we can say, you know what, it's interesting how the Bible actually talks about that. Our guest again, Glenn Stanton, and let me just mention the book one more time. We're just running out of time here, Glenn, but it's The Ring Makes All the Difference, The Hidden Consequences of Cohabitation and the Strong Benefits of Marriage. You can find out more at Glenn's personal website, Glenn T, with two N's, Glenn T. Stanton, glennstanton.com. You can also learn more about Glenn's work at focusonthefamily.com. Glenn, thank you so much for your time today. May the Lord bless you, and I pray that this word gets out in even wider in the general public.
Hey, likewise, Bill. Good to talk to you.
All right. Glenn Stanton here on the Faith Radio Network. Thank you for joining us today. And we'll be back next Saturday at 11 a.m. Central. Have a great weekend. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. For more information about the podcast, you can visit our program page at myfaithradio.com. Just look for Dr. Bill Meyer Live.